Hi everyone, I'm Megan, and welcome to Word Crash, the game show where we challenge our contestants to get creative. First off, let's meet our contestants. Hot on the heels of their new book, So Much Fire and So Many Plans, author of The Bleecker Street Bodies, and fresh from celebrating National Tequila Day, please welcome Aaron Gallagher.
Thanks for having me, Megan.
Next, he's written science fiction, comedy, and horror, an improv comedian who's performed around the world from Scotland to New Zealand, and can be found loitering at Portland, Oregon's Curious Comedy Theater. Please welcome Luke Salminger.
Hello.
Thank you so much for coming today. Nothing left to do but get to it. Let's play some Word Crash. Today we're going to start with a game we like to call Drop It. Drop a single letter from the title of a book or movie, and tell us what the new plot is. Luke, why don't you go first?
Yeah, of course. We're going to take that Chris Nolan classic, The Dark Knight, and turn it into The Ark Knight. This is a movie about Noah's secret security guy who's keeping folks off the Ark. Unbeknownst to him, we know he's going to meet a tragic end because we don't know his name from the records. But those of you who watch the film will know that his name is Hezekiah. And he kind of has a crisis of faith. So this is like a comedic drama. If I could have anyone direct it, maybe like Noah Baumbach or something like that. It'd be somewhere in that range.
I'm seeing an opening scene where the Ark Knight has to jump from the railing while the Ark is sitting there on the ground. Just jumps from the railing and comes down and starts punching people right and left. He's herding animals onto the Ark for people. No, get in there. Get in there. Keeping people away. Doing a nasty roundhouse kick to somebody's head. Yeah, I can see this.
Yeah, he's basically a security guy for a long while, because it takes a long time to build that arc. But yeah, like the climactic moment is when the flood, of course, inevitably comes, and he finds himself locked out after serving Noah. So it's a tragedy as well.
It is a tragedy. So who's the big villain?
Oh, I mean, Noah, really. Noah's the villain at this point.
Oh. That's interesting. So there's a betrayal going on here.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Our Ark Knight is our protagonist. He's been hired by Noah. But Noah knows that he can't bring this guy with him. Kind of being a jerk.
I'm seeing a scene early on. The rain is starting to fall. And the unicorns don't have their passes, obviously. So they're not getting on the Ark.
Well, those are the Ark Knight's pets, actually. That's why the unicorns didn't make it.
They were loyal and stayed behind?
Are you saying that there's a touching moment where, like, the rain is falling and the tears are just dripping down the unicorn's face, but you can see them because unicorn tears glow, right? And it's just this heartwarming moment of, we'll stay with you.
It's that all is lost moment that ends in that, like, tragic sacrifice.
He's got one arm over each unicorn's neck as the water slowly rises.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I can totally see that. Is it a twist that Noah is the villain? Do we know that from the beginning? Is there a red herring somewhere?
It is a little bit of a red herring because Noah is traditionally viewed as kind of a heroic figure, even though, like, when we look at it, he's abandoning a lot of people. Doesn't make him a great dude. And so we're kind of like, this film, like, is turning the head on the hero. The hero's the villain. And of course, being a Hollywood film, we are looking at a sequel, The Ark Knight Rises, which actually it talks about how the Ark Knight had been building in secret a boat of his own.
I feel like with this much water, you'd be missing a trick if you didn't have a literal red herring. You've got to have a fish who seems to be very sinister the whole time. Turns out he's a nice fish.
I'm kind of confused. Do the animals talk?
Yes. Yeah.
All the animals talk.
There's precedent for this. I mean, you know, we are, of course, using the source material of the Bible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in Genesis, we've got talking serpents. So it's not unheard of to have talking animals on this.
Maybe it should be a musical.
Ooh,
An idea.
Everything's always made better by a musical. Yeah. You know, with musicals, the whole point is you sing when your emotions can no longer be contained. And there's going to be a lot of emotions. Like Noah's saying, hey, the earth is going to be destroyed. Y'all are going to die. And so there's going to be some high emotions going here.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It's going to be torn.
Well, not only that, maybe some of Noah's family can be torn. Who likes the Ark Knight? There's got to be a love interest, right? There's got to be somebody.
Yeah. Did Noah have daughters? I'm trying to remember.
Like, I mean, he better have had daughters.
Well, he did have daughters, because there's a whole thing where, like, Noah's drunk later, like, after the flood, because, like, Noah feels bad or something and goes to get drunk, and they, like, his children see him naked. I know he has a son named Ham. So, like, maybe Ham and the Ark Knight are, like, best buds. Like, maybe Ham got his buddy this gig.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
yeah, he's like, well, surely we'll get to put a few people on. I mean, this thing's really big. Mm-hmm. Like, at least we can get Ark Knight on. And then, yeah, we'll have that touching moment where Ham will be like, I didn't know. And, like, the boat's rising. And then we have that, like, post-credit scene of, like, the Ark Knight has his boat. So it's not a full-on tragedy. And then that's setting up the sequel.
What did he make his boat out of?
I mean, probably some giant trees, scraps. Maybe Noah's scraps? Leaving a bunch of scraps around. Like, oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I would like to see, like, the water just off the bow of the Ark. The scene starts to fade out. His boat pops up out of the water. And there's two really angry unicorns shaking their hooves.
Ooh, yes!
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we'll definitely have to put the unicorns on the boat. I had not thought of that. That did not occur to me, but that's absolutely the imagery that we need for this.
There's going to be a beautiful water ballet scene at some point with all the animals in the water. Myriad flower shapes, fountains, swans, naturally.
There has to be a narwhal, absolutely. Wait, maybe the narwhal saves the unicorns.
Well, and that's the final, like, all is lost. Like, Ark Knight's not getting on, he's getting back to his boat, but the, like, unicorns don't make it in time, and the boat's rising, and then he's like, I've lost my friends! And then, riding upon the backs of the narwhal are the unicorns. Saved and delivered onto Ark Knight's boat.
There's symmetry there. I mean, narwhal are the unicorns of the sea, so, you know. Oh, that does beg the question, though. Is a unicorn horn an actual horn or an extended tooth?
That is the age-old question. I have always been, it is a protrusion of the cranium. They are like cone heads of sorts, if I can date myself on that reference.
I got that reference.
I made a Zima reference. You know I got that.
So I know I always wondered if that's part of their forehead. Does that mean their brain extends into it?
Oh, of
course. Or is it like a toenail?
Oh, I think their brain's in there.
Their magic brain.
Mm-hmm.
Does it end on a cliffhanger? I mean, it just ends with him popping up at the end, but that's it. We got to wait for the sequel.
You've got to wait for the sequel, Ark Knight Rises.
What's the plot for Ark Knight Rises then? Because we got to finish the story. We can't leave it hanging.
Well, I mean, Ark Knight Rises is, it's going to be a sprawling epic. It will be about, it'll open up with Ark Knight, but then it'll be about Ark Knight's children versus basically Noah's kids.
Ooh. Okay, we're going generational here.
Generational fight here.
Wait a minute. The Ark Knight's got to have, if kids, he's got, probably has a wife of some kind. Who else survives the initial flood, and how does he meet her?
I mean, just for kicks and giggles, let's bring some, like, some biblical weirdness in there. There's, like, the Nephilim or whatever, which are, like, the giant creatures.
Oh, the Nephilim? So, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Nephilim. Yeah. So let's bring that in. Like, why not? Like, have a Nephilim, two unicorns, and our good old Ark Knight. And so Ark Knight and Nephilim's kids are fighting Lot's kids. Ham and Seth and, oh boy, really wish I'd brushed up before I pitched this movie.
I have a question. Is the sea salty because of Lot's wife?
In this universe, I don't see why not. The oceans are receding, and so, yeah, Lot's wife washes away into the ocean. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so, the first movie is the Ark Knight gets abandoned. The second movie is that he leads a ragtag group of Nephilim, of people who come from angelic heritage and become monsters, all in attempt to get revenge. And unicorns, right? And maybe some other magical creatures that survive in a battle for survival against plain old humans. This is like mystical energy and magic trying to survive in a world that doesn't want them.
Well, and we're moving into a rock opera now. Like, the first one was a musical. We're heightening the stakes with all of these magical creatures now into, like, it is a rock opera.
Jack Black has to play one of the animals.
Yes.
Jack Black as a Leoplorodon, leading all of the sea creatures as the ocean is receding away after the flood.
With the beard.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Of course. Of course.
A bearded Leoplerodon.
You know, I think we should actually run this by Jack Black. He probably would take that role in a minute.
Yeah. I follow him on TikTok. He hasn't followed me back, but I'll make sure I'll pitch him that. So
yeah, get him a link to the podcast. He's going to love it. I guarantee he's going to love it.
I think the final conclusion of the film is going to be the Arknight getting petrified into a mountain, probably somewhere in Greece. I'm not sure where.
Yeah. This could be a whole series. There's no reason why we couldn't just keep going on.
I think this is ripe for fan fiction. No one could possibly ever get upset about that.
Not a little bit.
In no world. I don't see where there would be any issue.
Yeah. This is epic. This is absolutely epic.
Oh, yeah.
Birth of a new franchise right here.
Mm-hmm. We've made our careers. We're done.
Remember, it's always the same, but different.
It's true. Picturing Jason Statham with a unicorn horn. This has got to stop.
And what song would Jason Statham with a unicorn horn sing?
My Way.
Yeah, I see it. I totally see it. I mean, not really, but no, I totally see it.
I'm going to see it in my dreams.
I was thinking more of a sad ballad of just like, it's not easy being horny. Bring in, you know, some Phil Collins era, like, epic ballad. Yeah, I'm feeling it.
The horn tonight.
I can feel it in the horn tonight. I think that's a completely different song.
On the plus side, not only have we made an epic series of films, the sequels practically write themselves, but I think we also inadvertently wrote the porn parody.
Oof.
Too far? I went too far. I usually go too far.
Maybe I'll edit it. Maybe I won't.
Editor's note, I totally left it in.
I can't wait to see it on Broadway. Now, let's move on to Aaron. What have you got for us, Aaron?
I am a sucker, especially with Sylvester Stallone. I'm a sucker for a sports montage, training and stuff like that. So my idea was Aki, the story of an inner city octopus whose one goal in life is to be heavyweight tentacle champion of the world.
You know what? I know I said this last episode, but I'm going to say it this time too. How many boxing gloves does an octopus use?
Six.
Six. Okay. Six of them.
The fight scenes are going to be spectacular. We're going to get Jackie Chan to do the stunt coordination. In fact, I think Jackie Chan could play the octopus. I think he could play Aki.
Yeah. You know what? They need to film him three times standing in the same place, kicking and punching, and then they just overlay them. So it looks like he has six arms and he's got to coordinate it. So he's in the same spot the whole time.
You know what you don't see anymore in films? Rotoscoping. Instead of computer animation, let's rotoscope it. We'll just draw right over the top of the film. We'll animate Aki. He'll have six different colored boxing gloves. So the slow motion is just going to look like a rainbow. I think he should probably fight a gigantic cuttlefish. I think the cuttlefish is the heavyweight champion of the world. And Jet Li should play the cuttlefish.
Jet Li could be the cuttlefish. This is already exceeding my wildest expectations for a boxing octopus movie. But where does Aki come from? Why is he down and out? What's his world like?
Well, he grew up very poor.
What does it mean to be poor for an octopus? Do you like eat some kind of crazy food that no one would eat? Do you only have clothes for two arms?
In order to make ends meet, he had to work in the illegal sushi operations in Lower East Manhattan. Yeah, it's a rough trade.
That's very dark.
Yes.
The good thing about being an octopus is they can fit into really tight spaces, so at least maybe apartments in won't be an issue for Aki.
Oh, yeah. No, he's got a great place on somebody's doorstep in a jar. He could put the lid on himself.
Wow, that's got some serious overpopulated world vibes. Cram yourself into the smallest space possible, you know, because that's all you can rent. He is definitely poor.
I'm picturing one of those old-time metal frame milk jug holders, and there's a whole family of octopi living in these things. And they're always banging on the walls of their jars respectively because everybody's making noise and there's a lot of clinking and nobody can sleep, so all of the cephalopods are very cranky.
Is this a Who Framed Roger Rabbit style, like the octopus is animated in a human world, or like what are you envisioning here?
I would do that. I would go on full-on Blade Runner with everybody living on top of everybody who's living on top of everybody, just cram it full of darkness and rain, shiny surfaces, a lot of neon, Octopi are very good at changing their colors, so as Aki walks down the street, it would be visually stunning to watch him change.
It would. That would be fantastic. Who's his trainer? Who's the trainer who encourages Aki to move on, who's motivating him at all times?
I think we could do a crossover here with a very grumpy narwhal who's been around since the beginning of time. Just, you can't go wrong with a narwhal.
So the narwhal's got some kind of gruff voice, right?
Yeah, horns broken off at the end, so it's just flat instead of pointy.
What does he do instead of smoking?
Probably a halibut.
There's always a halibut sticking out of his mouth, right? It's just he's always munching on one.
Yeah, and halfway through the film, the halibut starts offering advice. Turns out it's not actually dead.
Perhaps it would be, instead of a halibut, maybe a red herring.
You win. Will Smith could play the red herring, because that's the kind of spunky, take-no-crap attitude that a red herring would have.
It is. I don't think we could get him to play that, though. I think it's way outside, you know, the kind of role he would take. He would never do something like that. He's a very serious artist.
He would never play an animated fish in a terrible movie.
Yeah.
Last actor I know who did that was Don Knotts, the Incredible Mr. Limpet.
Yes.
Wow, you are bringing me back to, like, I was 2 or 3 years old when I saw that. Sitting on my grandparents' couch.
I mean, Don Knotts, very specific niche, but man, there was just the single actor there. There's De Niro, there's Brando, and there's Knotts. They just, you know, it's like Eastwood. He is who he is. Everything he played, he was Don Knotts, and he was completely believable as Don Knotts.
The power of having the right writers for you, am I right?
Oh, absolutely. You got to find people that fit just right.
So if I remember the plot to Rocky, you know, it's got to go up and down, right? What's Aki's lowest point?
I think that's when his girlfish leaves him. He starts seeing a local fish, but she doesn't want him to fight because she's afraid he's going to get hurt. So halfway through the movie, she leaves him and he goes into a depressive spiral. Literally, you see him spiraling down the street to land in the gutter, changing to the color of trash. But there's got to be something that picks him up. There's got to be a moment where he realizes this is my dream and I'm going to follow it.
Luke, what is that moment?
I think we're going with the all is lost moment. Like, he's got to get his life, his family, their jars get broken. And he's got to earn some cash to get some new jars for his family. And so he's going to enter the big fight.
He's going to pull himself up because his family needs him. And if his girlfriend left him, well, he's just going to have to struggle through anyways.
He has an advantage because he goes down and it's a lottery. Whoever gets the big fight, they're going to be drawn out of a fishbowl. And everybody has to sign a slip of paper. But he's got so many arms, he's able to sign a lot of slips of paper. So the big reveal, they reach into the fishbowl, fish around. What do you know? Aki.
I don't know why they would have a fishbowl underwater, which is what I assume this takes place, but I love the idea that they'd use a fishbowl.
Well, it's representative of where they came from. It's sort of a celebratory fishbowl, symbolic of their exodus from, you know, a fishbowl. That could also be the trophy. Fishbowl goes on top of the trophy. So at the end, when Aki inevitably wins, his family gets to live in this ancient traditional fishbowl. Basically a mansion for fish. Aki's adopted, so all of his family are minnows. They'll fit perfectly within the fishbowl.
There you go. Now you're talking. Now I see it now. I was envisioning a bunch of octopi, but that's not good enough. An octopus adopted by minnows. Let that sink in for a second.
Well, of course they had to adopt him. When they found him at the shelter, he was the only one in the whole place that could hug the whole family at the same time. Very touching moment.
We have to see that in flashback.
That's the moment when he's at his lowest. He remembers that day in the orphanage and hugging, like, fistfuls of minnows. And that's when he picks himself up out of the gutter and says, you know what? My family needs me. Cue the music, of course. That would be the training montage. And the best part is you'd have to shoot it in slow motion because his arms move so fast.
So there is that iconic scene of Rocky punching the side of meat, you know, and probably breaking a bunch of spare ribs and making people unhappy. But he's punching that meat as hard as he can. What does Aki fight? What does Aki use instead of that big old chunk of cow?
A porpoise.
A porpoise.
Yeah. It's symbolic. It's sort of a play on words. That's his porpoise in life. I can't believe I just said that.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Everyone listening to this is going to flip out over that one.
Oh, yeah. I will take myself to the penalty box now. It's terrible.
And Luke is laughing at us because, you know, he's a real comedian, doesn't have to stoop to the level of our puns.
Oh, I love a good pun.
Well, let us know if you hear one.
So far, you're tanking.
Oh.
We'll just all tread water until we're done with this game.
You're going to have that moment in Aki, where his manager does, in fact, die. Goes belly up. That's when the herring comes in. That's his new manager. That herring is going to be there for him in his corner. Half a herring. Yeah, half a herring with teeth marks.
The left side or the right side?
Whatever looks best in post.
Of course, that's always how those things work. Nobody plans those. Well, the camera's looking this way. We need to be the left. That's the shot of the day.
It'll play better on that side. You know, there's something about that that's always disturbed me. Rocky beaten on that side of meat. I watched that movie the other day, coincidentally. And they actually interviewed him on TV while he's beating the crap out of meat. That is not sanitary at all. There should have been, like, masses of people at the TV stations protesting outside the meat district. They should have just gone crazy. That was just, ew. Anyway.
I'm sure everyone in the Meatpackers Union was very upset that they brought people in there and would depict something as unsanitary as that, you know, as what happens at their place of business. That's their trade. And I am not kidding. They probably are very pissed. Every time I see someone use a computer on a TV or a movie and they're doing something ridiculous that no one would ever do, I get mad. So I can only assume that if you're a meatpacker, you're also upset at Rocky and those people for being in that room.
I forget what I was watching, but I saw someone using a computer on a TV show and both of their hands are on the keyboard and they're typing and the mouse cursor moved. Not just like drifted, like clicked. So, yeah.
Here, let me do an impression of people hacking. I'm in.
You nailed it. That is hacking right there. That's how you do it. Although you are missing the soda or coffee, usually both. There's got to be piles and piles of empty cans of caffeine distribution vehicles behind you.
Something like, I am a robot that turns caffeine into lines of source codes. But back to Aki.
Back to Aki.
Aki. What's Aki's last name?
Odes.
Aki Odes. I'm sorry, I need a second.
Do you plan on releasing a Ben and Jerry's flavor? Like a tie-in, like as part of the marketing? Like an Aki Odes ice cream?
I think they already have the little candy octopi for some reason. I don't know why I think I know this. Maybe it's in fish food or something. So they could do Aki Ode.
See, Megan and I are planning the movie. You're living in 3021. You're already at marketing, which is so forward-thinking.
I believe in this pitch.
Well, I think Aki would also have, you know, the little floaties for little kids. We could have all kinds of Aki merchandising, right? The little floaties for kids, maybe gloves, but they have tentacles coming off them too. So you're with all little fists on the end. So you're punching with hands that have fists on, with tentacles that have fists on them.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, yeah. And the wacky wall crawlers practically sell themselves.
Time to bring that classic back, right?
Time to soil another generation's walls.
I think that we have a fully developed Aki Ode. His epic struggle to pull himself...
By all 16 of his bootstraps.
By all 16 of his bootstraps up to a better life by punching other fishes is a story for the ages.
It is. It's a classic. It's going to be considered a classic in 100 years. They're going to be teaching this in film school.
Now it's time for Secret Sauce, where our authors share a technique or strategy they use to keep the creative juices flowing. Aaron, how about you go first?
I would love to. I think one of the things that the 8 people that I've ever talked about my work tell me is that my dialogue is really crisp and authentic. So I think my personal secret would be to tell people to eavesdrop as much as possible. Listen in on every conversation you possibly can in public, especially when they don't know you're doing it. Not in like a creepy way, but it's good to listen to the cadence in people's voices because humans speak very lyrically. We're very musical critters at heart, even if we aren't musically inclined. Accents especially, there's a lilt, there are rhythms and rules. And if you really listen and you learn those things, that will come through in your dialogue and make your characters really leap right off the page. That would be my advice.
When I took a class in improv, back when I was living in Chicago, they had us follow someone. Just, we were in the middle of class, and the teacher says, okay, go out there, come back in 10 minutes, and follow someone around for those 10 minutes. Looking back, it was creepy. But none of us got caught. So I guess it's okay. Anyway, from that stalker in training experience that they gave me, I was able to really get a feel for a character just looking at the way somebody acted or talked or moved, right? The clothes that they wear and their attitude. We spend our whole lives around people, and yet the details don't seem to matter, right? So whatever, I'm doing my stuff. Honing in on that really helps you build people.
Absolutely. If you're any kind of writer at all, your characters talk a lot. Because half of the interaction in a book is going to take place between your characters. The dialogue should be not only vibrant, but I think it should be distinct. I do this thing with my own work where I blank out all of my speech attributes and I read my dialogue out loud, and if I can't tell which character is saying which line, I go back and rewrite it till it sounds like them. It helps me keep that consistent voice all the way through. And that's just a byproduct of walking around and listening to people and getting to know their mannerisms and their tics and all the various stuff they do. That's my advice. Eavesdrop as much as possible. If you can do it professionally, that's even better. If you can get paid to do it, it's like getting paid to do research.
You mean, sure, like, that would work. If you were an FBI agent or a CIA agent, and you could spy on whoever you want?
I bet that's why so many former intelligence agents write books.
Hmm. You've cracked the code.
It's true. It's completely not true. Asterisks. But yeah, that would be my advice. Listen to as many different types of people as you can. Go places you don't normally go. Listen to people you wouldn't normally hang out with. Everybody's got something to teach you.
Love that. It's great.
Well, thanks for that. I'm certain we'll all be stalking way more people now because of Aaron's advice. Luke, don't, what is your secret sauce?
So many secret sauces. I'm a saucy guy. When I am feeling stuck, giving myself permission to step away from the work to go and read something or even like travel, if it's like a 5-minute walk or if it's like a 3-hour drive, like getting myself in a new physical space and imagining new stories in those spaces really helps spark some creativity. If I'm feeling stuck on a piece of work or something like that, and I'll even like switch genres. So if like I'm writing something comedic, like just like a comedic sitcom, I'll like go somewhere and start imagining sci-fi and like allowing my brain to like make that switch back and forth kind of breaks my brain and like knocks some of that rust loose, whatever's sticking in my head.
I totally get that. I'm currently writing a sci-fi series, and when I can't write any more of my sci-fi series, I turn around and start adding lines to my urban fantasy novel, right? And you think, oh, you're writing, so you take a break by writing. But there's no pressure for the urban fantasy novel. Things just occur to you, and you got to get them out, right? So taking that break, and I totally understand moving on to something else, as long as you finish.
I read somewhere that one of the reasons when you're in the military, especially in basic, that you run for a while and then you jog for a while and then they run some more and then they walk and then you run is because switching up the speed at which you move actually helps you rest. So it makes perfect sense that switching between genres would give different parts of your brain a rest.
I know a lot of people really want to stay in their lane to like, you know, learn something really well. And I'm a big advocate of that, of course, but I'm like, explore other things, especially if you're putting pressure on yourself to work in a certain realm. Like, this is the thing I'm doing. stepping into something else, even a different medium, is extremely helpful. So like if you're writing a play, go write some short fiction. If you're writing short fiction, write some poetry. Find ways to just have something that you're not putting pressure on yourself to, because that will knock some of that creativity loose.
I've always suspected that that's why we have so many sonnets from Shakespeare. I think that's what he did to unwind from writing his plays. I think it was sort of like him taking a lap, just walking around the block, only he would write a couple of lines in iambic pentameter and then go back to, well, writing in iambic pentameter. But different types of genres helped him keep it fresh. And if it worked for him.
Iambic pentameter, that is something that needs to come back.
Oh, absolutely. I'd like to see, like, an epic sci-fi spoken entirely in iambic pentameter.
Don't look at me when you say that. That's not my thing.
Well, I loved Deadwood so much. Deadwood has a lot of its dialogue in iambic.
I mostly watched it for the swearing, but yeah.
Yes, that was filled with a crazy amount of swearing. Just a crazy amount of cursing.
If you watch it and you imagine that nobody has any shoes and there's Legos everywhere, it makes perfect sense.
That needs to be a YouTube channel now. Just a Legos cut with even very bad B-roll of someone stepping on a Lego, and then you just cut to Deadwood, like, reactions. And that's the entire YouTube channel. Just Lego, crunch. Like, yeah, crunch. Yeah.
In fact, you could probably do it with lots of different movies.
Yeah, actually, anything where they get really, really upset, it would work beautifully.
But I know The Witcher drops the F-bomb a lot. Like, if we just have The Witcher stepping on a thing and him just very quietly saying his classic line.
I'm a little embarrassed to say I've never played the video games, and I haven't watched The Witcher yet because of Mission Impossible. I loved him in Man of Steel. I like him as Superman. I think he's a great Superman. But that moment in Mission Impossible when he comes through the bathroom archway and he, like, cocks his fists, I haven't been able to take him seriously since. Anyhow, that's a whole other podcast entirely. Reasons why I can't take Henry Cavill seriously. That's actually the only reason. Short podcast. We're done.
Well, for the record, I really liked him in The Witcher. His strong but subdued acting style fits that character very well. You know, he emotes. He does emote. It's not like someone who's completely dead on the outside. You know, he emotes, but when he does, it has a certain gravitas to it where you're like, oh, he's pissed. Or, wow, he likes her. Or, you know, something like that. You know, it's clear, even though he's supposed to be stoic and unfeeling.
I think there's a lot of subtext with Henry Cavill, mostly centered around his jaw. I think if you watch the angle of his jaw, you can tell his emotion. It's a working theory. I haven't done absolutely any research, but, you know, it's possible.
I auditioned to be a Henry Cavill, like, stand, and, like, this is not a bit, this is a real thing. I was like, they wanted a Henry Cavill lookalike for a Witcher tie-in product for, like, a mobile game, I think. I didn't get the part, but it was nice to be considered.
I'd play his jaw.
Do you play his jaw?
Yeah.
That's really why they cast him, is his jaw.
Well, someone's got to take over for Bruce Campbell, you know? He can't hold on to that legacy forever. He's going to have to give it up. You know, I can't think of anyone better.
I'm going to go ahead and assume you've read his autobiography, If Chins Could Kill. Not making that up. Dead serious. That's the title of his autobiography, If Chins Could Kill. And a friend of mine went to a signing, and so excited. He gets up there, and there it's Bruce Campbell. And Bruce looks up and says, what can I do for you? And my friend, the first thing that popped out of his mouth, something insulting. Bruce shrugged and wrote in the book. So my friend has a copy of If Chins Could Kill, and the inscription is, Dear Phil, thanks for shelling out. Sucker! Bruce Campbell.
Something insulting. That is great. Well, that's exactly the kind of secret sauce people are looking for. Insult your fans. You know, have a big chin. I think that's the moral of this story.
Yeah.
Our next game is called Trope Nope. Tell a story trying to avoid at least one common trope. Luke, what did you bring us today with Trope Nope?
I love the stories of the big bad that's been locked away for a millennia, or just like biding their time, these evil forces. Your Lord Sauron. So like, what are you doing for like a millennia? Like you're just sitting around, or like the Stephen King evil is locked away. So I wanted to avoid that and like talk about Lord of Grievance. So there's this evil medieval lord who has wronged hundreds of peasants and citizens and slain many folks across Europe, and then is locked away by a wizard and awakes in the 21st century. He is coming back after being wronged by these wizards, but instead of seeking vengeance, he is seeking apology. So he's going down a list of all of the people he wronged through his evil ruling and trying to find their heirs, their offsprings throughout generations, and offering penitence to all of these folks. He is the Lord of Grievance.
So wait a minute. How long has he been out again?
500 years.
500 years. That's incredible. How does he get out? Is this one of those things where there's like a ritual summoning and someone's trying to summon a Dark Lord, but instead they get this guy?
100%. Yeah. There's a secret cabal who find out about this like evil guy. He's kind of like a Rasputin-esque evil bad guy. And they're like, oh man, what if we brought him to the 21st century? And so they do this summoning. They find the crypt in which he has been locked away. They open the seal and he comes out. He's trying to learn about the new world and stumbles across a self-help book and realizes that it's amazing that audio can like come into your ears from this like rectangle device. And then the words start hitting him that like he's not living. He never lived a fulfilled life. Part of repairing that is repairing the damage that he caused.
Who's the first person he tries to help? What does he try to fix first?
Well, at first he goes to try to find the family of peasants he turned food away from, stole their land, burned their crops, try to find those offspring, get their land back for them. Unfortunately, skyscrapers now are on that farmland.
The thing is, tracking someone through paperwork and stuff is going to take a long time. Could he have something magical that'll help push him towards these people?
Yeah, it's the internet. It's called Ancestry.com. It's amazing. He thought he would have to like find some bards, do some summoning. He learns about the internet. Also a great spot for product placement.
Yeah, they would totally help sponsor this movie or book. Go all the way back 500 years with Ancestry.com. Not a sponsor, although reach out to us at Ancestry.com. Is he all alone in this venture, or does he have some kind of sidekick?
He thinks he's all alone. But then the wizard that locked him away was also in another crypt sealed away and also comes out. And it becomes this buddy cop. Or not a buddy, but it's a buddy film. It becomes a buddy film of two folks lost in a modern world and have to come together and reconcile their own differences as the wizards realize they hadn't approached their wrongs with our Lord of Grievance, who is a... His name is Harold, by the way.
Harold, Lord of Grievances!
If he's not hanging off a clock tower at some point, I'm going to be disappointed.
You always have to bring Big Ben into it.
This feels to me like it's going to have all the beats of a Planes, Trains, and Automobiles.
Mm-hmm. That's why the wizard locked himself away as well. He realized what he lost. The movie is about him finding redemption, too.
He lost his purpose. Because he had trained his whole life to defeat the Lord of Grievances. When he was done, there was nothing left for him to do. So he's like, my only purpose in life is to defeat this guy. So I've got to sleep for 500 years now until he wakes up so that I can wake up and take him out again.
Well, like he realizes that he's no longer complete. The Lord of Grievance has a mission, but the wizard just follows him around with unrequited love. And every time he tries to tell the Lord of Grievance how he feels, it just gets all botched up and they end up fighting more.
This is also why I'd love a good story about villains. Heroes, often their only goal is to stop the villain. Like, you remove a villain from so many films and the hero really has no goal, which is often why they put a romantic interest into these films, to have the hero have some other goal. But we're turning that and being like, yeah, he has no other purpose. And so he seals himself away. Perhaps when the other seal is unlocked, his own seal unlocks as well, so he can enter whatever time and emerge together with his arch nemesis, who is actually his true purpose.
I've often wondered if the hero just looked the villain right in the face. Because you got so many villains, especially Bond villains, huge tropey Bond villains. They're going to take over the world. They're going to do this. They're going to do that. If you just look them in the face and engage them in a conversation, what are you trying to do? I'm going to take over the world. Okay. And then what? What do you mean? Well, what do you do the next day? There's got to be a conversation where the wizard is trying to teach the Lord of Grievance. You need a longer goal than just your list of grievances, because once you get to the end of the list, then what? And the answer, of course, is the wizard. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like the Dark Knight when the Joker said, I'm like a dog chasing cars. I wouldn't know what to do with one if I caught one. Catching the car would be the worst thing for the villain to do. So yeah, I think it would be cool for the hero to illustrate that and teach them. It's a teachable moment.
So this 500 years, Luke, this 500 years that the character is sealed away, is he just asleep? Is he doing something? Is he conscious? Is this like the Phantom Zone?
Knitting.
Knitting. No, I think he's has to replay in this like almost personal hell, like everything that he did with his life up to that point. And that's when he emerges. He's like, I need to say I'm sorry.
Aww.
And then what does that do? Like, what? And he has to confront, like, this. Is this a selfish thing? Is this just for me? Do these people know that I have impacted their life 500 years ago?
He still has magical powers, right?
Harold never had magical powers.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought when you said the Dark Lord, I was thinking Sauron and stuff where, you know, like...
Well, let's roll it back. Why not give him incredible powers? Like, what would those powers be? I mean, all of the things. I mean, lightning. He's raining down fire on everyone. We can play around with that in the modern world in which lightning is running around him all the time with power lines. We could have this, like, to the modern world sort of moment with that as well.
I was going to say the middle third of the movie could be him trying to explain his awesome, phenomenal powers. I can conjure lightning, Taser. It would be cool to see all of the things that he can do. I know this instantly. Yeah, I have Google. It would be nice to see all of his powers just completely negated by modern technology.
I can talk to you from any distance. I can send messages back and forth.
Hold on, I'm on my cell.
Yeah. All of our sufficiently advanced technology that is indistinguishable from magic.
We're all evil lords at this point.
Oh. Some of us are more evil than others. Some of us are just more mischievous.
Mm.
I'm liking this concept. This is a fantastic concept. We have a redemption arc. What is the big thing, though, that our protagonist, needs to get over? What's that last thing? We can have a montage of him helping these people and that people and using his magical powers to give them a chance to walk again, pulling people out of comas, whatever it is. We'll win the lottery because he thinks it's a good idea for them to have money. We can do all the easy stuff. What's that one difficult thing that he's going to have to struggle to get? He's going to doubt himself because he can't do this one.
I mean, forgive himself.
Aww.
Like, that's that. He gets to the last chapter of the audiobook. Like, the audiobook is kind of like this, like, step by step of living a fulfilled life. And, like, he realizes he's never forgiven himself for these things.
He listens to a chapter and then stops it and runs off to complete that chapter. So he doesn't understand that there's more. And I don't know what to do. Maybe the book has the answer and he plays it and it's about forgiving yourself.
That montage, it has to be set to the audiobook talking about the different things you need to heal yourself. He's just going for it, you know? Yeah.
It's like the Aki montage, but without animation.
And no musical this time. I'm glad we came up with something that wasn't a musical.
It's true.
Mm-hmm. There's room for it, though. There's room.
Lord of Grievances, the musical.
Music by Lord.
Music by Lord. That is just funky enough. Someone should take a stab at it.
Got that nice melodramatic kind of like sadness, like just oozing out on stage.
Someone get Lin-Manuel Miranda on the phone. I think we could totally take this on the road.
Lord of Grievances. There's an arc. There's an end. Is this a one-shot deal? We've done so many other franchises. Is this a one-shot deal, one and done?
This is one and done. Like, sometimes you just need a self-contained story.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, because there's not much... Once he's redeemed himself, What does Happily Ever After, though?
I mean, at that point, we do like an Odd Couple spinoff with the wizard and him. It's like very tonally different. It's for the silver screen, but it's like an odd couple. It's like this evil lord and their wizard living together in a small apartment in Cleveland, Ohio.
Perfect. Perfect.
Give it a budget, put it into production.
I think everyone is going to expect to see these pop up on Amazon very soon.
I'm talking Absolutely. To John Mulaney and Nick Kroll about being in Lord of Grievance, so.
Yes. Yeah, you got the casting down.
Will Ferrell has to be one of the ancestors.
Of course. And a grown-up Pearl. That's a deep cut. That's Will Ferrell's first landlord sketch where he has Pearl, his, like, I don't even know, three-year-old niece. He's like, give me my money. So she has to be, like, I don't know, 20 years old now? Let's make Pearl a star.
That would be cool.
Aaron, what trope are you noping today?
I am a big fan of slasher horror movies. So I tried to consider what would be the best anti-slasher trope film. Takes place on a brightly lit afternoon in a mall with a group of very diverse people of color, all walks of life, who never separate. The killer never appears behind them. And at the end, when they do finally confront one another, they sit down and talk it out. It's called Mall Cope. They help this poor, unfortunate killer get over his issues and really find himself.
Okay, so we do establish that this person is a killer. What's that establishing scene like?
Killer accidentally stabs a mannequin. Our ensemble sees him stab this mannequin, and he's visibly upset that he didn't kill someone. Oh. And, like, on many levels, this is an incompetent killer. It even opens up with him running from the police after killing someone and hiding out in the mall. So we know that this person is a threat instead of just completely incompetent.
Well, wait a minute. What if we assume that he killed someone and that's why he's running from the cops and he is incompetent and stabbed the mannequin, but he didn't actually ever kill anyone? Because if we're going to redeem somebody, it's not going to feel right if they redeem somebody, if they make him better and help him cope, if he's actually killed people. Because there's going to be a lot of people who are going to be like, no, he should go to jail. But if he's never actually killed people, we don't reveal that to the end. It's like, you know, oh, no, I tried, but I missed.
The cops are not actually chasing him. They're just trying to give him his keys back because he dropped them. He thought he was stabbing a clerk, got the mannequin, thinks he killed somebody, and now he's on the run. Our group of people, middle-aged, by the way, with completely stable personalities, saw, and that's why he thinks he has to kill them.
How are we going to avoid the tropes in the group of people? Because, you know, you always have the slutty one, you always have the sporty one, you always have the smart one. How do we disrupt that?
Actually, I take it back. They're not middle-aged. They're elderly. They're a group of mall walkers. That's how you avoid that.
No. There are plenty of slutty mall walkers.
Not going to the same malls, apparently.
I mean, this is literally a thing. Besides college campuses, the highest rate STD infections is retirement homes.
That's true.
Any particular place you put a lot of people together and there's no kids and there's no responsibility and there's a lot of free time, things are going to happen. Disturbing things that will haunt you in your sleep, but things will happen.
It's true. It's a beautiful thing that you never want to see.
Is this a trope, though, that we can actually get rid of? Or do we need to have the sporty one and the slutty one and bratty one?
You've got a geriatric girl band going on there. I'm actually envisioning it somewhat like Space Cowboys, where you had Clint Eastwood and Tommy Lee Jones and Donald Sutherland, all these elderly astronauts. Mm-hmm. I would love to see that same kind of dynamic. They were slutty. They were sporty. They were adventurous. And now they're just sort of cranky and wondering why someone's chasing them very slowly with a knife.
Maybe someone just went through a breakup. The older you get, breakups get worse and worse.
Oh, it's true. Especially if the person they've broken up with is part of the mall walkers.
Oh, so we've got exes. Exes in the mix is always great for a horror film.
Yeah, but they get along well.
It's always very hard to create conflict in a narrative when everyone's getting along.
It's true.
So how do we Star Trek this?
We need tachyons.
The love interest, the ex, the breakup, should be the killer.
I don't know. I hate to say no, right? I want to say yes and, but it just feels a little bit like they need to be the older people kind of guiding him, right? He's like a 30-something. He's a lost and drifting 30-something who failed at his startup in his 20s, didn't do great in school. He's been failing and failing, and now he's just mad at the world.
You know what you never see in slasher movies? A May-December romance. I think it would be cool if the killer was exactly that, but they had broken up with one of the ladies. Maggie May would be the song that would play over the credits, of course. I think that would lend a level that you just, you know, there'd be a texture there you just don't see in most modern slasher films.
So he gets dumped for, we'll say, the slutty one.
Or the sporty one.
So he gets dumped, and he's so distraught that he decides he's going to kill them all?
There's got to be a reason for him to have attacked that poor sales clerk. Maybe she reminded him, or he reminded him, of the person that just broke up with him. I mean, if you want an extra layer of conflict, one of the 41's adult kid is the one that made him break up.
This is disgusting. They are 10 years younger than me, Mom. 10 years younger. How can you date someone like that? What happened to half your age plus 7? That's the rule. You know how embarrassing it's going to be when you and him show up at Ted's parents' Thanksgiving? What about Christmas? You know what you're doing to me? You have to stop this, Mom, right now. End it.
There's got to be a line in there where he gets upset because she has to buy, or he has to buy him the alcohol because he's that too young.
No, it can't be. Can't be that young. Can't be that young. 30-something to 80-something is still 50 years.
What? It's like Harold and Maude with a big-ass machete.
Oof. Yeah, Harold and Maude is problematic.
That's a hard sell.
Yeah. 30, 35, I could see that.
You gotta really stretch. The characters really have to be organically messy. People are messy, and this would be a very messy movie. But it would challenge so many preconceived notions.
How many times does he fail? Because there's got to be a whole slew of times where he tries to kill them and fails.
Well, he tries to catch them outside the pretzel place. Slips on a pretzel. Let's see, what else would happen? He loses them in a Hot Topic because he never expected them to go into a Hot Topic.
I think every encounter needs to like be a reflection of like his growth as well, though, as well as like hitting on these anti-tropes. So like the slutty ones, like the quote unquote slutty ones, maybe they're hooking up at the Gap and you're like, oh, this is the moment where they get killed. And like we frame it that way. But then something about the way they talk about love stops him from killing them. And then like the sporty one is talking about like self-doubt in the like, I don't know, what's a sports shop in a mall or something like that.
Dick's. It has to be Dick's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. Especially for the name. Yeah.
No, I love this. You take every one of these tropes and you show that these people aren't that trope. Is that what you're getting at, Luke?
Yes. And that trope, as we reverse it, it leads to growth within our killer. Like, it's a reflection of like, oh, I'm feeling these self-doubts. And by the end, they're like, oh, I don't need to kill.
The final scene takes place in a jewelry store where he narrowly misses his target, trips and stumbles into the engagement ring counter, and there runs into our mall walker's 50-year-old son who feels bad and was buying an engagement ring for them, because you have to bring it full circle.
Yeah, that works. And it becomes heartwarming.
Yeah, heartwarming. Except for the mannequin.
Because of all the good it would do, the mannequin was probably okay with that.
Yeah.
Maybe the mannequin ends up with someone at the end, too. Gets positioned next to one of the other hot mannequins.
The new life at Forever 21.
Yes. Before we go, it's time to give our authors a chance to talk about what's new and exciting in their lives. Luke, let's start with you.
Yeah, I am doing a lot of screenwriting these days, and I'm really excited. I'm putting into production a short film about an evil botanist creating plant creatures to fight back against global warming. It's called Vines, and we're planning on shooting in 2022. I've got an amazing team on board, and I'm really excited to be filming that, as well as a couple short films this fall.
That sounds incredible. If you need an extra, I am here for you. I'm here to be your extra. I don't even have to talk. Just, you want me strangled by a vine or something, I'm your girl.
I will definitely keep that in mind. Yeah, and then all of my previous works, I've got some short stories, some comic books up on Amazon, and a couple of things I can't talk about quite yet. But yeah, I'm really excited about some upcoming podcast debuts. So check out my website, lukezwan.com. I'm at Luke Zwan on all of the platforms, although Twitter is my preferred medium.
Normally, I just let people move on at this point, but I have to know. What are the comic books?
Ooh, I've got a supernatural western. It is set during 1863, and it's kind of during the Bleeding Kansas. So it's an exorcist during Bleeding Kansas called Ezra, Devil Begets Devil.
I'm going to Amazon right now to look at that because that sounds amazing. It's right up my alley. Aaron, what's new in your life?
Well, my next novel actually releases on Wednesday, So Much Fire and So Many Plans. You can find that basically anywhere the books are sold, Amazon primarily. And next month, on the 22nd, I'm going to be at the Mississippi Book Festival in downtown Jackson with Indies United Publishing. So that'll be fun. If you happen to be in Jackson, come down and make fun of me.
Well, that is fantastic. I'm sure a lot of people will be thrilled to see you down in Jackson. Sounds like a super fun experience.
Here's something.
But your book's going to be released. Is it an ebook or do you have a hard copy too?
Yes, it's available in both ebook and paper form. You can order either one to your heart's content.
Let's talk about some of your other works for people who, you know, might not be familiar with them.
Okay. I work in nearly every genre you can possibly imagine. I have done detective noir. I have done sci-fi. I have done steampunk pirate books, thrillers with motorcycle gangs in the 1970s. I did an urban fantasy trilogy. Let's see, what else? Crime fiction, heist books. I do 5 different series right now.
That is prolific. Tell us about the motorcycle gang.
Nomad is the story of a displaced biker. He gets kicked out of California. He's no longer allowed in the state. So he's trying to find a new home. A different chapter of his club ends up in Jericho, Arizona, where 5 years previous, a different chapter of his club was completely wiped off the face of the planet. They were all murdered, and nobody knows who did it. So while trying to find a new home with this chapter in Arizona, he starts looking into that. And then, of course, calamity ensues when he starts uncovering answers that nobody wants uncovered.
Calamity ensues. Normally, yeah. I hear hilarity ensues, but calamity ensues is just, if not more, powerful.
Well, I haven't written a biker comedy yet, but if I do, then hilarity would ensue. But in this particular case, you know, there's a lot of trouble. It's also notable for being the only book my dad has read. The only book of mine my dad has read. He really liked it. If that's not a glowing endorsement, I don't know what is.
Parents reading your books, it's either they do and they love you and you're perfect and you can do nothing wrong, or it's just something you do that they don't interact with at all.
I wish I could say that doesn't happen, but I have encountered way many authors where they're just so desperate to have anyone in their immediate family read their work, and it doesn't happen. I have yet to get an actual review out of anyone in my family.
I have given up, maybe not given up isn't the right word, but like no longer put weight into having friends and family either read my things or watch my things. Like, you know what? They're not my audience. I still love them. They're not my audience. And I've come to terms with that. And my parents waited 10 years to watch me perform improv comedy. They came once and they're like, that was something that you did. And they have not been to a show since. I'm okay with it. And I think if they'd come earlier and weren't happy, I would have been devastated. But now I'm like, you know what? That's okay. We can still love each other.
I have made the terrible mistake of recording a number of my sessions at the Brody Theater and posting them on my YouTube channel. I get all kinds of feedback about those from friends and family, way more than anyone who would actually spend time coming out and seeing them.
I have live streamed my improv shows, so that's a whole nother level of a trust fall, as it were.
Wow.
That is. But you know, if you're running without a net anyways, you're going to do it. Does it matter if there's 5 people or 1,000 people in that audience?
No. Nope.
But hey, if you're ever going to Twitch stream, let me know. I will totally be on board for making a fool of myself in front of as many people as possible on Twitch.
I will hit you up.
Who is the victor today? You tell us. Tweet us at @WordCrashGame and vote for your favorite story of the night. Did you prefer Aki Ode and the tentacle-punching madness of this undersea story? Or was Ark Knight more your thing? And feel sorry for those unicorns. If you're listening on YouTube, remember to like and subscribe, get in those comments, and tell us how you would tackle our questions today. Everything we talked about will be in the links below. Thank you for listening. I'm Megan, and this has been Word Crash, reminding you to always get creative.